Hello, everyone. This is the Finer Things Club, where we talk about our favorite books in a very civilized way. My name is Zoe Banaja. I'm here today with Trip and Nick. Say hi, guys.
Hola.
Hello.
Hi. And today we are reading 1984. This is our second episode. I got a microphone now, which is nice.
Very fancy.
Quite fancy. Thank you, Ashton. And we are going to talk about some George Orwell.
Animal Farm?
Not his real name. Did you know?
What's his real name?
I should have brought that in with me. I did not, but it is definitely
Eric Blair.
Ooh, really? That is a fact.
Eric Blair.
That's a good name too, Eric Blair.
Yeah, George Orwell sounds more forceful.
It does.
Well, you know, since we are saying true things about the book, let's get started. I want to start every episode with a summary of the book for those of you who have not read it or who have and need a refresher because you read it in the 12th grade like I did. So who wants to do that? I should have asked before we started recording.
Okay.
Nick, oh. Trip.
Wow.
I meant to say Trip. Can you
time it?
Yeah. Trip is going to summarize 1984 by George Orwell in, let's say, 70 seconds.
70 seconds.
Oh, we've given extra time.
10 seconds.
I mean,
I don't know if I need that much, honestly. All
right, 60 seconds.
60 seconds. Oh,
okay. You know what? We're no changing. Handicaps. We're moving. Let's go.
No handicaps.
Tell me what, Nick.
Okay, hang on. I'm just going to change. That's the timer noise. Okay. Well, are you ready?
Yes.
All right. And go.
George Orwell's 1984 is about a man named Winston Smith who works for the overwhelming, overarching party of power, just called the Party. He works in the Ministry of Truth, where his job is to alter facts of the past and change history, as it were. And the first is broken up into three sections. The first section just details what the world of Oceania is like and their wars with East Asia and Eurasia and the world and the awfulness that entails in that world. The second part follows his love affair, his, you know, lurid, you know, lustful love affair with a woman named Julia, who works in the Inner Party, which is a higher ranking part of the party. And the third part of the book is about their eventual capture by the main antagonist of the book, the Thought Police, and the subsequent torturing and recalibrating of Winston's mind. And the end is very, very sad and depressing. And that is, in essence, in 60 seconds, 1984.
Wow, he's been practicing.
Bang.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. That it is a dystopian novel. And it's about Winston and his demise. Or his mind demise.
Mind demise.
But that's the, as our professor would say, the little A. So as we know, every book has a deeper meaning. What is the big A? What is it really about to you guys?
I think it's about the inevitability of things, especially in this particular dystopian world. And something really interesting about it was that the whole book, Winston and Julia are saying, yep, we're going to get caught. Like, what I'm doing is wrong. We're going to get caught. It's inevitable. And I think that's a really big part of it, is this knowledge of inevitability and this this unquestionable thing, that this unquestionable negative that's going to befall them and happen to them. And the lack of privacy that comes with it, and the uncertainty of anything, and the intangibility, if that's even a word, of this, you know, larger evil, you know, Big Brother and the Thought Police. And and that is a very broad way of putting it, I think.
Nicholas?
I think there's a lot of themes in this book, a lot of different ideas that all kind of surface throughout reading it. I think that if we're going to say there is a big capital A, capital letter idea in the book, it's kind of buried in there. But I think the main concept or idea or theme, as it were, is hope.
Interesting. The opposite.
Yeah, because like there is this whole thing where Winston and Julia keep saying we're going to get caught, and they're constantly talking about it. And throughout the whole book, really for most of it, Winston is going on and on about how you really can't do anything without getting caught, and how the way the thought police and society works is pretty soon you wind up getting caught and killed for something you didn't even do. That's like pretty, it's pretty much inevitable. And the whole idea is that your ending is going to be inevitable, but there's all these little nuggets of hope buried throughout the story. Like the proles who keep singing, you know, despite their circumstances.
The proles are the proletariat, the really poor people who live in the neighborhood.
The lower class.
The lower class.
And he talks a lot about just this idea that you kind of have to hope a future generation is going to have it better, because you can see your whole life laid out ahead of you, and you can see everything that's going to happen to you, including your eventual capture and death and being erased from history, and how it's like the worst thing you can go through. But you have to kind of hold on to this hope that at some point, eventually, hopefully, maybe it's going to be better for someone else. But for the human race, ultimately, like, there has to be this hope that it will get better. Otherwise, why don't we all slash our wrists with razor blades right now?
Right. Okay. Yeah. I mean, both of those things I think are quite there in the story. It's like I think it ends kind of on Tripp's note, but maybe, like, you know, maybe if we're talking about, like, we already knew that in the end he was going to lose. Like, he knew in the end that he was going to be caught and he was going to be killed. He did not know it was going to be so soon after. Like, Winston Smith has, like, this whole idea. He's like, I think there's, like, a secret, like, society or the Brotherhood that's, like, fighting against our government, and I'm going to try to be a part of it. And, like, literally as soon as he thinks he finds it, he gets caught, because it wasn't. And he is brainwashed and tortured, and in the end he's like, yeah, they're right. But I think that you could still say before that everything he did was still worth it, because he did, like, it happened. And I think that's something that's not really touched on specifically, that he's saying that, like, you know, the big brother can't take away the fact that he loves Julia, and he can't take away what's in his heart. And then, but, like, in the end, they kind of are able to do that. They're like, yeah, yes, we can. But they still cannot take away the fact that it happened, which, now that I'm saying that, they're kind of like, yes, we can, because we control the past, because they're able. So maybe, I don't know. It's like a mixture of all things.
Well, and also with, like, Winston and Julia's love specifically, there are a couple times towards the end of part two, I think, where Winston says that I love her, but I don't feel anything for her. I love her because I am supposed to, and I just do. Mm-hmm. I think that he has this knowledge kind of the whole time that, yes, like, I'm doing this just because I am supposed to, or because I am programmed to, or because, you know, I am part of the Brotherhood, or want to be part of it. I want to follow Goldstein. So this is what I do, without actually having much conviction with it, as it pertains specifically to him and Julia. Because that was really interesting when he was just like, yeah, I love her, but yeah, I don't feel anything for her, but
really
I love
her. I'm scared right now.
I mean, Winston and Julia's entire relationship is kind of built on that, because the first time they ever interact with each other, it's her faking getting hurt so she can slip this guy she's never talked to a note that says, I love you. And he's like, oh, okay. Because they just live in this society where she recognized that he is against the party, and he recognized that she's against the party. So they're like, well, we're the only two people we know who can feel comfortable enough saying we're against this. So we love each other, right? And, you know, I mean, it works for a little while. It's kind of the only thread that binds the two of them together.
Mm-hmm. They're like the only people they know, basically.
A quick sidebar of that. And Zoe, because Zoe was talking to me about it, and she's like, wait till I get to part two. Like, it takes a left turn. I didn't see that coming at all. Like that was one of the strangest, most quick, most out of the blue kind of happenings I've encountered in a book. And I was like, oh, wow, all right, it's a love story now. Cool. Like,
I remember being quite excited about that when I read it in 12th grade. Did you guys read it, by the way, in school?
No,
but my sister read it in middle school. So there was a lot of
middle school. Interesting.
Maybe it was like eighth, ninth grade year. I don't remember what year it was, but there was a lot of discussion about it, especially in her class. They talked a lot about the ending of the book. So I knew about the part with the rats, and that was kind of all I knew.
Mm-hmm.
Everything else was new.
In the end of the book, if you do not remember, the way that they finally get Winston to denounce Julia is by threatening him for rats, which we get a hint of. It's called foreshadowing. In the second part of the book, he sees a rat, and he's like, I am really afraid of rats. And then she's like, whatever. And
they were going to let the rats eat his face. They were going
to. He was like, do it to Julia instead. And they're like, all right, your transformation is complete.
That would be a really grisly way to die. I would really not like to have a fencing mask of a rat cage wrapped around my head to have hungry rats devour me.
Pretty
negative.
That is, thanks for bringing up Trip, why I wanted to talk about, like, why we read this in today. Like, why is it being taught and why is it, like, readable, if that makes sense? And, like, why do you think that is?
There's always going to be parallels to a modern time. You know, when you're talking about such an established writer writing about the future, there's always going to be themes that are relevant, maybe more so today than we could have imagined, because I've read a lot of times in various articles and websites, the world has progressed so much beyond what Orwell ever could have predicted in terms of, like, lack of privacy, at least.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1984, no one can ever be alone because there's always screens watching them. And they call them telescreens. In a very, like, obvious kind of way, we carry screens literally in our pockets everywhere, and we can't even get away from it because even if we put our own phone away, everyone else has one.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of this obvious sort of parallel that there's just no privacy anymore. Any kind.
I think that's a very important thing too. I think it's taught, at least because hearing Nick's sister getting taught in, like, middle school, even like 12th grade, I guess is more reasonable. But like in middle school, I think it's trying to instill that individuality is not a negative, and that it is important, in the words of the book, to be unorthodox or to have lots of unorthodoxy in you. I do think that obviously the privacy thing is, you know, very, very prescient and very important too. I thought after reading it that, because my dad asked, oh, is today like 1984? I was like, oh no, it's nowhere near it. I thought that the world outlined in this was far more dire and far more negative and much less hopeful than things are now. Even if, you know, privacy is, you know, WikiLeaks and Julian Assange and Snowden and NSA and all this stuff that's very, you know, very topical, very in the news, and even like today. I don't think that our society is really quite anywhere near this. I can't even really picture a way where it gets to that point. I don't know.
It's because we're not actually living in a society where the information that is collected on us is used to, you know, force us down and force us into these roles. And, you know, people just get killed and we all worship a supreme leader that doesn't even exist. Like, we're not living in that crazy dystopia. But I think the part that's scary about modern times is that all the elements necessary for that
are there.
I mean, I was like really struck by the fact that, like, okay, it's not the way that it is, you know, for Winston, in that, like, okay, we're not being listened to in a way that, like, we'll get murdered for what we say today. But we're definitely, like, the proles, the way that the lower class is described as living. I was like, oh, that's just us. That's how we are now. And it's like, they're just described as, like, living dirty, and they're so small that, like, the government doesn't care what they're doing, but, like, they're poor and they're not being treated well and they're being murdered and, like, their neighborhoods are not policed well. And, like, they're just like, okay, whatever, just let the proles do whatever they want. And, like, so in that sense, we are kind of, like, in the way, in that we are being, like, I don't know, we are, like, carefully left to do what we want. And like, if anyone becomes important enough to like actually watch out for, then they are watched out for. But in a certain sense, like,
well, that's like the Occupy Wall Street, you know, like we're the 99%. And like, it's like in 1984, it said that the inner party is 5%, outer party is 10%, and then the rest of it's just 85%. Yeah. So to the point, yeah, like it is very much like, the lower class, the proles are too deaf, dumb, and blind to get themselves out of their current situation. Therefore, they are not a threat to overthrowing the party, which is how the party is able to, you know, continue. Right. So I guess, yeah, in that sense, you're very right.
And then, like, they're like, yeah, sometimes they get upset about a thing, but it's, like, one thing. They don't really see that, like, what the larger problem is. Like, a scene was described where there was, like, not enough pans or something, mm-hmm. and like Winston's kind of a jerk.
Winston's totally, 100%.
Like, oh, I guess he's a hero.
Not, I don't think so.
No, yeah, no, that was sarcasm.
Oh.
So he like is watching a scene where a bunch of like proletariat women are fighting each other over some pans because there's a lack of pans, and they're just like, you know, like, rah, and they're all mad at each other, and they don't see that the larger problem is that not that they are stealing each other's pans, it's that there is a system that they're in that is like not providing for them, and it's not working out, and it's because of the larger problem that they should rise up together and stop something, but they don't recognize it. So I forgot what the original point was, but
no, yeah, or like the woman who's outside of Mr. Charrington's treasure store. I'm gonna call it treasure store. It sounds right. There was one line where Winston was saying, "There's this large woman who's continually singing this one song over and over again." You know, pinning clothes on and going back and forth between her and her children and whatnot. And Winston was saying that, "I wonder if she had an innumerable supply of clothespins and children, if she would just do it for all her life, and she would just never stop singing and pinning clothes on the wire." Like, they're preoccupied with the non-important things,
which is us a little bit. Yeah, and so I made a couple of points of like where we are connected to 1984 that I saw today, which was the government watching us also always. It's not always the government. I feel like, you know, everybody's always upset. They're like, man, like the internet heard me talking about like wanting a new, trash can. And then my Instagram gave me an ad for a trash can.
Don't care for that at all.
Very real.
I think that's kind of convenient, but
that's what they want you to think.
But yeah, so I have that. What I really thought of why I picked this book was this, like, you know, not to get too political, but like this current regime that we were under, that like untruthfulness is part of their brand, and like they just don't care. And like, I remember reading when I was reading this in 12th grade, I found it very difficult to conceptualize this idea that, like, and so does Winston in the book, that they're expected to, like, so there's this whole thing in the book that, like, there's three big states, like, big governments, like Oceania, East Asia, and Eurasia, and they're always at war, but two of them are always in an alliance. And whenever they switch around, the people in Oceania are expected to believe like, oh yeah, now we are at war at East Asia. We have always been at war at East Asia, and we will always be, even though like 2 weeks ago they were at war with Eurasia. And so like, I just couldn't understand that, like this idea of doublethink, which is big in the book. I couldn't understand like, how could like somebody do that? But like in today's times, if somebody in our government says like, oh yeah, I was holding a red rose and it was, I liked it. And then 2 weeks later, I'm looking at some roses. And 2 weeks later, he was like, I was holding a yellow rose and I hated it. And people are like, that's not true. We have a picture of you and we have a clip of you saying this other thing. And he's just like, no. I mean, like, what do you do?
I mean, yeah, like, you know, speaking of Trump and like the our current government.
Oh, like, no one said
like,
Trump.
No one said Trump.
I said Trump. I said Trump. Speaking of Trump, like it's like the thought of fake news, I think, is like, it's like that phrase, fake news, I think could have very alternative facts, I think very easily could have come from this book. Or you know, Dick Two's always point, like the when he was like, yes, I had the biggest inauguration crowd size in history.
Crazy.
And there's literal evidence to, you know, deny that, much like how with Winston, they're like, yes, we've been at war with Eurasia, East Asia, whichever one it was at the time, since this date. But he found the picture of the Jones and Aaronsford and the other guy with a date that proved that was wrong. And there's like, no, yet didn't exist. Yet
you
never happened.
It.
Yeah.
And yet there are actually people who heard Trump say that and believed it.
They believed him. So that's like, it's, you know, it's real. Like, so therefore we are in 1984. When are we? Who knows?
It's like a very,
I also, the other two things they had were was this idea of newspeak, which is really interesting to me, that they're like, restricting our language, they're like creating a new language that is basically like shortened speak, where like they're getting rid of as many words as possible. So instead of bad, there's just good and ungood. And so like versions of that.
Double plus ungood.
Yeah,
just don't. Very, very bad.
And the idea is that one day everybody will only speak this, and therefore it would be impossible to think of like, hey, this is uncool. Like, it's just impossible to have that thought. Like the idea of complex language being taken away takes away complex ideas. And kind of not that I think that's true necessarily, but like the way that text speak, and like the way that everyone's just sometimes I can't express myself unless I use an emoji. Like, you know, like I want to express myself fully, so I have to use this picture. And like, I think that's, you know, kind of connected.
Did either of you read the like, and then like
the afterward?
Newspeak part at the end. I read a little bit of it in the beginning. So this is interesting. It's kind of interesting, actually. Mm-hmm. And I'm doing some research before I came here to tonight. And they were saying that, and again, I didn't read all of it, so I can't speak to it personally, but they were saying that in the little, you know, newspeak explanation part, that they're referring to the party and newspeak in the past tense. So I was reading that some scholars, some people much smarter than myself who know this book very well and inside out, have taken that to mean that the newspeak part at the end is like written well after the fact and the party's fallen and whatnot, because it's referred to, they're like, yes, like newspeak was like this, the party was like this. And I think that's very interesting. That's something that
that's kind of hopeful. I
didn't read the whole newspeak thing and I haven't explored that further, but that's at least a somewhat popular theory.
If you would allow me to re-explain that for non-creative writing majors, wink, wink.
creative writing degree.
Because the narrator in the story is the third person, and it's written in past tense. So the idea, Tripp is saying that like when the narrator is explaining things to the audience by saying like, oh, this is how you say this in newspeak. He's saying, this is how you said this in newspeak. And they're saying, therefore, whomever this narrator is telling the story in past tense in a way that implies that the government has fallen. And even though, because it's like, it used to be like this, quote, even though we're sad for Winston and Julia, they didn't get there. Yeah. I liked Julia. I like Julia a lot.
Julia's so jaded.
Okay, hold on. But yeah, basically we're sad for them, but we can have hope in a future in which they are, when the government has fallen.
Yeah, exactly.
This appendix sounds like it was written by George Orwell speaking directly to the reader, less than like it was written by someone living in a post-Oceania society.
Oh, maybe I explained that wrong. So he's talking about the appendix specifically.
Yeah, not it opens in the story. With Newspeak was the official language of Oceania and had been devised to meet the ideological needs. And then on the next page, it says Newspeak was founded on the English language as we now know it. So the idea being, if you read the book and then read the appendix, it sounds like the appendix is being written in a time beyond Big Brother, like when all that is over.
Right.
But it sounds to me more like it's actually George Orwell saying the story is over. And now I'm talking to you,
the reader.
About this language I made up. But it could be either way, which is why I guess there's scholarly debate about it.
I think, yeah, I think the George Orwell talks to the reader probably makes more sense. That's probably it. But I think it's a really interesting wrinkle that Newspeak was the official language of Oceania. Oh, it took me like 2 days to, is it Oceania? Is it Oceania?
I have no idea.
I'm so glad. It makes me feel much better. I was like, this is a...
Oceania.
O-C-E-A-N-I-A. Oceania?
Oceania.
Oceania
is cute.
I was looking at like a fictional map of like this world, and the Oceania is so much larger than East Asia and Eurasia. East Asia is like literally just like
Africa.
It's like I think
it's
China.
Only half.
China,
yeah,
Japan.
Yeah. It's like East Asia is like some of Russia and China and Japan, and like Oceania is Britain and all the Americas and like some of Africa and Australia. It's so much more expansive that I was like it's odd that they haven't been able to conquer these enemies.
Well,
but then I'm like,
they
don't
need to anymore.
They have no desire to.
War is the point. Perpetual war is what they're going for.
Interesting.
So says Emmanuel Goldstein.
Nuclear rhetoric.
Ooh.
Yeah, and then the last thing I had for like what I thought was a connection was the fact that like they had this thing called Hate Week, and like everybody is just like you know, encouraged to be upset and like mad about the people they're at war with, and like all these bombs keep happening and everyone's scared and mad, and like it kind of reminds me of this, like we have a perpetual like, oh no, there's a caravan coming to attack us, and it's like these little things that are like, they're not really threats, but you know, they're used to occupy and distract the proles.
And whip up emotions. I thought the 2 minute hate was like a really that was one of the things where I was like, I almost could get into something like that.
Yeah, I read somewhere said that it's like a Twitter thing. Like, you know, when Twitter's like, Twitter, do your thing. Here's a racist to ruin his life, and like we do it. Everyone's like, I hate him so much.
Bill Maher.
So you're going.
Like
you're getting fired. I'm gonna get your degree revoked.
I'm gonna get your address. Get your work place of employment.
Be sleeping on the park bench in 10 minutes
because you said something racist
8 years ago.
Yeah, we're gonna get you
when you were 12.
So there you go.
It's kind of like the little like 7 year olds who call people out and get them killed.
What? Oh, yeah. It's like, you were saying that people do
in
that
real
now.
Life. You know.
It's like, I didn't go to that elementary school.
I went to a Christian school.
Yeah, so let's take a break.
So maybe not.
Okay, we're back. So I wanted to talk about some other dystopian stories that I saw this book made some connections to, like in The Handmaid's Tale, that is written it's written in first person, and she's kind of telling, she has the same dilemma that Winston does, because Winston has a journal in the beginning of the story that he's like writing in, and he's like, why am I doing this? Nobody's going to read it and it's going to get me caught and it's stupid. But June, I guess is candidly her name, kind of. She has this kind of dilemma where she's like, who am I telling this story to? Like in a sense that like the narration. And she has this really cool line where she's like, well, you know what? Whatever. That's not the quote. But she goes, I tell, therefore you are. So this idea of like Winston feels compelled to tell his story because perhaps it means that somebody is listening. If he is telling the story, that means someone is hearing it, which I thought was cool. And
Nick and I both nodded in agreement.
They did not read The Handmaid's
June
Tale.
June is from The Handmaid's Tale?
June is from The Handmaid's Tale. But also she doesn't have a name in the book. That's kind of like what people guessed her name is. And that's what her name is in the show. So I consumed both. And then like I also saw in The Hunger Games this idea of like, which was a really, really big theme in something I can hear you in the it's a really big theme in The Hunger Games, or sorry, in The 1984 is the name of the book.
The 1984
is the idea of like the only thing they can't take from me is the fact that I love. That's like the big human thing that you can't force out of someone. But then the government's like, yeah, I can. And they do that in the third Hunger Games where they like take PETA, and PETA's like whole character trait is like, I love Katniss.
Don't get me started.
I didn't say that to be mean to PETA. I really like PETA. But they brainwash him. They kidnap him, torture him, brainwash him, and then let Katniss save him. And when he like sees her, he's like, I hate you, Katniss. They brainwashed me to want to kill you. Which is like his main problem in the third book and like stuck with him long after. So I thought those were two cool comparisons. I wonder if, you know, that's like a dystopian thing, like this fear of
mind control
and this fear of not being able, like not being heard, because like you're like, no one's going to hear this anyway. I'm shouting into a nothing, but you are compelled to speak anyway.
Have you read Brave New World?
No.
Aldous Huxley. No, I have not.
That's also a dystopian novel written in 1932, before Ooh-hoo. This book came out. I've not read it either. I'm going to read it.
Oh, man.
I was like, he's got dates. Nicholas has the author name.
Trip got the Brave New World. He has the drug Soma.
No, okay.
It's all about drugs.
Yes,
Aldous Huxley loved the LSD.
Loved the LSD, but that's another dystopian new world where in that one, the population is not controlled through brute force and vaporization, but through addictive, pleasure-filled drugs and just like pleasant little activities. So that's something I wish I had read it. I'm going to read it next, but that's another.
Much rather live in that one than this one.
Yes, this one sounds much more pleasant. While I was reading it, because I'm much less literarily inclined than Zoe and Nick are, it made me think of specifically part one and part two reminded me of Westworld season one, in the sense where you have Winston kind of awakening and, you know, becoming sentient, becoming like, I am not a lunatic. Like I am not crazy for thinking of these things. And it was like him coming to this realization that, there's this whole other layer to things. And then there's this, and a conspiracy, for lack of a better word, that goes a lot deeper than, most of the proles and most of the party members are willing or able to reconcile or, you know, recognize. And in Westworld, the one that's what it's about. That's about like Dolores and the Man in Black and everything, you know, realizing that they are robots and that they are in this park. And that's what it struck me as. And also struck me,
spoiler alert.
No, if you haven't seen Westworld season one, get on that, my friends. It's a great, great show. It also, this book struck me like the movie Full Metal Jacket did by Stanley Kubrick, in the sense that they're both just kind of hopeless, I think, a little bit, even though we talked a little bit early about how it might not be hopeless. I think it's a little hopelessness, kind of the point almost, but it just gives you these little glimpses into these unremarkable, in the larger scheme of things, unimportant characters, unimportant people. And Full Metal Jacket is about the Vietnam War, and the main conflict is just this one small little skirmish in a town where like half the, you know, people in the band die, and they just keep on keeping on. And that's essentially what happens here. You know, we are the dead is what Winston and Julia say before they're caught. We are the dead. That is what this other character, O'Brien, tells them. Like, are you willing to do this? This, kill children, throw acid in their faces, torture, murder. You are the dead. You know, you are merely cogs in the machine for the hope of a brighter, better future generation from now. And I think, and that really reminded me of that just sense of, while I am making the ultimate sacrifice, what I'm doing will largely be forgotten. I am kind of just, you know, ashes in the wind, as it were. But at some point or another, hopefully what I'm doing now will have some kind of importance or relevance.
That's an interesting comparison, because 1984 is written and published in the year 1949 about a future thing and saying, this could happen. What are the implications of this? And Full Metal Jacket is made about something that had already happened in the past, you know, being the Vietnam War, and saying, look at all these sacrifices they made, but we already live in a post-Vietnam War society. We can already see how that kind of amounted to nothing, how the Vietnam War was, you know, stupid and pointless and just a terrible idea. And really, there's no historian that will say, oh, it's a good thing we got involved in Vietnam, because it wasn't a good thing. And it's just looking at things, one's looking at the past and saying, here's how we messed up, and one's looking at the future and saying, here's how we could mess up. I think that's interesting, because one has the hindsight to say, we already see how pointless this was. And one of them doesn't have any hindsight at all. One of them is looking completely into the future.
Yeah. So those were the two things that, two comparisons that struck me while reading this book.
Oh, that was very interesting. One thing that you brought up that I thought was a really cool part of this book, or whatever, not cool is maybe the world, but this idea of, like, we are the dead, and even, like, in the sense of being in that world, they're like, okay, if, like, you know, me thinking this way means I'm already dead. They're already going to catch me. They're already going to kill me. But, like, it is in a larger sense as well. There's a part in the book that says, as long as we are human, life is the same thing as death. Like, you're basically a corpse waiting to be buried, which I think is pretty dark, but, you know.
But I'm pretty sure that's, like, the point they were trying to get across, right? Like, that's, like, kind of the crux of the whole thing, is that, like, these people just come and go, and they're vaporized and they're erased. They're gone from history. Like, they never existed. They weren't were, they weren't are, they won't be. Like, they came and now they are gone forever.
It's meant to be scary because we can only conceptualize the future in this terms of one day I won't be here. And when we look at it with such an egocentric view, you know, as us, like, one day I'll be gone, it's really hard to see the bigger picture of it. And in 1984, there's this big scare, especially for Winston, where he's just thinking, I'm going to be dead one day, so I'm basically already dead. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the idea that death is eternal, death is forever. So, you know, and being not born before you were born is also a different kind of eternity. Just this idea that life is like this little flash bookended by eternities, and for the larger portion of all time, I will not exist. And so he's saying, well, then we don't really exist now either. And Julia, who is sitting there listening to him, is just kind of like, oh, shut up, Winston. Like, we're having sex right now.
Yeah, like,
do you not feel me? Like, touch me. Like, if you can touch me right now, then you are alive right now. And even though you'll be dead one day, and even though the party will probably erase you and no one will remember you, and it will be like you never existed, and for all intents and purposes, you know, using all kinds of rhetoric and logic, you really technically never will have existed. Like, this moment did happen where we were together, where you were touching me, when we were loving each other. And I think that's much bigger and more profound than this idea that, you know, we're already dead.
Let's talk about Julia. More Julia.
Yeah, more Julia.
So you said you think she's... what you said was very Smart.
I like what she said there, but I think that that's kind of her blessing and her curse, because she's like, what, 15 years younger than Winston?
She's about 26. Yeah.
She's 26, he's 39, so she's 13 years younger than him. So she's, you know, she's pretty young. She's not like as young as we are, but she's pretty young. And she thinks she's got it all worked out. And Winston is like, no, you don't have it all worked out. And she's like, but I do.
And she's like, I don't care also.
Yeah. She's like, what does it matter? And there's this part that really speaks to me about Julia, you know, because I like her and I don't like her. And it's for the same reasons. Winston is looking at this proletariat woman, the same woman who's been clothes spinning clothes and singing. And she's just old and she's kind of beat down. She's covered in calluses. Her skin's all red. She's, you know, put on a ton of weight. And he's saying, oh, she must have been so beautiful for just this short little amount of time when she was like 18. And then as soon as she started having kids, like life started burdening her and weighing her down. And she just became bigger and uglier and grosser. And she's still out there like singing and happy and hopeful. And Winston looks at her and he says, that is beautiful. And then without even like looking, Julia like glances and says, her hips are meter wide. She's not beautiful. And Winston's like, no, but see, that is beautiful. And for Julia, because she's so young, it's this very surface level, like, what are you talking about? She's not beautiful. Look at her. She's fat. And Winston's like, that you're missing the point completely. So Julia, to me, is so strange because I understand her kind of hopeful, idealistic, youthful sort of ideas about, hey, we're here. Enjoy it while we're here. But also she's got these rose colored glasses where she's just like surface level in a lot of ways.
I mean, to be fair to her, like literally before he said that, he was like thinking of in the ways like, okay, she's beautiful because of what you described that. But he's like, but he says also, it literally just occurred to him. So he thought that always. It was just in that moment that he's like, you know what? I'm very deep. My name's Winston. And, you know, that woman's beautiful. That's beautiful that the circle of life is like that. Isn't it, Julia? And she's like, I guess not. He's like, oh, you're so shallow. but literally 10 minutes before, he's like, yeah. That he called her monstrous. He calls a lot of people monstrous in this.
He's outer party.
He's what?
Outer party.
Oh.
So, you know, he's been kind of living in this other kind of jaded society for a long time, which Julia's in that too. You know?
Yeah. I mean, but yes, what you're saying is correct. And like Julia is very, she can be frustrating in that sense. But I think that like it's admirable in a sense that like, you know, I know you dislike Katniss, but it reminds me of Katniss in a way that she's like, I don't care about all that revolution stuff. I care about my life right now, which is like this.
I like Julia. Parts of her bother me because I feel like I'm seeing the bigger picture that she's not, which is just bias because I'm living not in her world, reading about her from a different character's point of view, basically. Katniss, I don't even want to open that can of worms.
Okay.
Katniss is totally different.
Jim, what do you think about Julia?
I don't know. I don't feel strongly for or against her. And I think that's kind of the point. I think that she could have been replaced by anyone, and so could Winston. I will say part two, I thought was kind of a drag.
Oh, so kind much of better than part one.
Part one and three were easily my favorite. Like,
part one was the worst.
I thought part one was funny. I thought that there was lots of just little odd mannerisms and like dystopia. And this like insistence that everything smelled like sweat and old cabbage. I just thought it was like really, really darkly humorous. I was like actually like kind of like busting up at points. I'm just like, it's like in part one when Winston's, you know, first writing in his journal and he's talking about how he's at the movies and he's like describing the scene where he's like, And there's his mother and children in the boat and they get blown up by rockets. And then he just says, great flash or terrific flash was the turn of phrase, terrific flash. And they're just gone. And then a wonderful shot of a single hand upwards. I don't know. I thought it was, kind of funny, kind of really darkly funny. But Julia, I don't know. I agree with what Nick said and what you're saying. Like, she's this weird, you know, kind of foil to Winston. She's like, yep, we're here now, so we must like it. But I think that she does humanize Winston a lot, and like, mm-hmm. her action
makes him a lot more interesting.
Yeah, yeah, and like her actions, especially like in, you know, Mr. Charrington's upper place where she brings the you know, the real coffee and the real sugar and everything. She I think is the most human character and the mm-hmm. most normal, as it were, in like quotes, because, you know, what's normal, and especially what's normal in this book. So I think that she provides some levity and some just like a little glimmer of hope, a little glimmer of lightness to kind of take away from the overwhelming darkness and badness. But Julia's, I don't know, neither her nor Winston really inspired me as characters or struck me in any like really meaningful way. I thought their relationship was, I don't know, just kind of there, just like a plot device. What?
That's the meaningful part.
Yeah, yeah.
No, they're just kind of there.
Yeah.
I mean, I liked her because, like, this, I don't know, she kind of feels like a modern woman where she's just like, I don't know, look, I do my job and I go home and I just want to do it.
Like, I thought it was really funny when she was like, Wince is like, you like boning? Like, not just me, you just like boning? And she's like, yeah. And he's like, great. Like, I love that about you.
He's like, how many people have you slept with? She's like, hundreds. A lot. He's like, oh my God.
And this is right after she takes off her anti-sex league uniform.
Oh yeah, that was, I thought, was a funny thing that I wrote down. That when he first saw her, he was like struck by how sensual her and her, what's it called, the chastity belt made her hips look.
And it clung to her hips. It gave her hips a perfect form.
Also, something that always bothered me about their relationship is that, like, Winston, like, you know, he's like super down. She like passes him this note that's like, yeah, I love you. And he's like, oh yeah, cool. Let's, we're in love now. Cool. Let's go, you know, hang out in
hold
some ways.
Hands in a crowd of people.
But literally 2 seconds before that, he was like, he just saw her and was like, he's like, I want to murder
her.
I'm going to beat her head. And then she like, as they like have this romantic like fling in the woods, and she's like, honestly, Winston, like, they're British. Honestly, Winston, like, tell me, what did you first think of me when you saw me? And he's like, haha, I wanted to rape you. And I was like, why would you tell her that? That is not, like, you know, it's like one of those things that are like, yeah, when I first met you, I hated you, but now I love you. He's like, no, when I first met you, I wanted to rape and murder you. And she's like, oh.
But she gets it because that's where their society is.
And that's what she was trying to put off, like, that, because he wanted to attack her because he thought she was so, what's the word?
He thought that she thought he was orthodox. Yeah. And that's the thing, pure. Is that they live in this society where you see someone that you think is opposed to your way of view, and everything you've ever learned just taught you, I need to do the worst things possible to this person. In his case, rape and murder and bash her head in with a stone or whatever. And she hears that and she's not like, oh my God, really? She's just like, oh, yeah, of course you wanted to do that to me.
I mean, it's still kind of harsh. It says some weird stuff about him as a person.
It does say some weird stuff about him as a person.
To that same point, I thought, and I didn't mark any points down to back up what I'm going to say, but I thought in general the book was like kind of really coarse towards women. Just,
yeah, no,
for the most part. Like, I was like, not much, not many positive things. Not that there's many positives to be had in general, but I thought a lot of like the ones like, this dumb B word essentially was like the general tone and the general like feeling of Winston towards women. I just thought it was something that would fly in 2018.
You know, I was reading it. It's one of those things where you're like, is the author sexist or is he trying to make a point about sexism?
Well, 1940s were a time.
Hard to say in a book this old.
Yeah.
But yeah, he like even Julia, who's supposed to be like, you know, she's the good woman, she like makes a point to say, ugh, I hate women. And you're like, okay, well, you know, she's not like all girls. So I guess
she's
we
not
don't
like other girls.
Yeah, come on. Winston. She loves to do it. So, yeah, I just wanted to, we got some more minutes and I wanted to talk about like, more of Winston and how I kind of disliked him. And like, there's a scene where his torturer, O'Brien, whom he's like, oh, like in love with, do you guys have any reason? Do you know why he seemed to be so in love with like his torturer?
Yeah. At the time of his torture or before?
All times. He's always like...
Well, because before he had... At the open of the book, he's already had this meeting with O'Brien where he thinks O'Brien's trying to tip him in to the...
They had a flash of the eyes.
Yeah, and he said...
And he had that dream.
We'll meet you in the dark place.
And meet you where there is no darkness.
We'll meet you where there is no darkness. And he's like... I don't know, but if I know anything, that's O'Brien trying to tip me off. So he's like obsessed with O'Brien because he's like, he thinks O'Brien is his in to the resistance.
But he's not.
But he's not.
Well, so he, there's a scene where O'Brien, where he's like, there's, you know, mankind is like good and we're gonna stop you guys eventually. And O'Brien's like, if you are a man, you're the last one. And also, look at you. And he like shows himself in a mirror. And after like some time of being tortured, he's like starved and he's all beaten. He looks super gross. And he's like, if this is mankind, haha, it sucks. And like, honestly, it does kind of, because like this idea that Winston is the everyman of this story. And he's like very, you know, like, wow, he's like super tortured. And he's like, man, like, I think things used to be better. Like, I feel like there was a time where you could just lay in bed with your girlfriend and not be afraid of being murdered. I don't know. I'm making fun of him for that. But he, like, there was that scene where he was like sitting in the room with O'Brien. He thought that he was being tipped into the resistance, and he was just like, O'Brien's like, would you murder, kill kids for me? Would you, like, do this? Would you do this terrible thing? Would you throw acid in an innocent person's face? And Winston's like, yes, yep, uh-huh, and, like, not even questioning it. And then, like, the same thing where he's talking about he had a wife who left him, and he's like, yeah, I almost killed her once, and if it happened today, if I had the chance today, I would kill her. So, like, I don't know, but that says this idea of, like, this is humanity, and he is humanity, and it's...
It's just because they couldn't have fun doing their duty to the party.
It's a sex joke. Related to the book. Okay, so, I have some quick questions for you guys. What's scarier, 1984 or 2018?
1984.
I wasn't there in 1984.
Without question.
Yeah, probably 1984.
Without question. But, I feel like.
But yes, definitely 1984.
I only brought up the wife thing so I can ask this question. Would, if you had a jerk wife who may or may not like turn you into the authorities and forces you to have sex with her all the time, but she like super isn't into it, and you're like, can we just stop? And she's like, no, we have to, because it's our duty to the party. And you're like, ugh, okay. If you were at a top of a cliff with her and nobody was around, would you push her off the cliff?
Would I as Trip Westmoreland, or would I as Winston Smith?
I don't know.
Yeah, probably.
Nick would do it. Trip would do it. Oop, I'm sorry. Trip
confuses too much. We don't look anything alike.
Do you guys have similar sounds in your names?
For the listeners out there.
You're sitting really close
together. For the listeners out there, I'm like 6'3", 220 in black, and Nick is the opposite of that. Nick is just none of those things. So.
Nick?
I probably wouldn't push my wife off a cliff, because I'm imagining, unless I'm in this actual scenario, if I'm in 1984 in the situation Winston was in, I feel like my own personality is probably too much of a coward to push her off a cliff anyways. But I like to think if I were in that scenario, I would, you know, be able, I don't know why,
but
I
why?
Would say that.
Why would
because
you
because I don't want to get turned in and tortured and taken to room 101, where they have your greatest fear, and it's you know, as much as we talk about, oh, that whole thing with the rat sounds terrible, I'm like not afraid of rats. I would hold a rat.
You like rats.
I do. I love rats.
They're active. That would be really bad.
But I would think it would be really bad to have them eat my face out. And yet, in room 101, they would have something so much worse for me, whatever it is, because they have your worst fear. And knowing that, you've got to push her off the cliff, right?
Yeah.
You can't have any loose ends.
If you push her off the cliff, I feel like you might get caught anyway.
Well, that's the whole thing, is that Winston's like, I know I wouldn't have gotten caught. So if the scenario is you might still get caught, then no, I wouldn't push her off the cliff.
Oh, okay.
In 1984, you're just doing everything you can do to not get captured and killed and vaporized, right?
Yeah.
That's the end goal.
That's the goal.
Survive as long as possible.
Who is Oceania Edwardith with?
Big Brother.
Oh, bumper. None of the above. All the above. Both Eurasia and East Asia. Themselves.
Victory Party gin is what they're up against.
I do know that I want to try some of this victory coffee.
I want to drink this oily gin.
Sounds gross. It was described as being very bad. I don't know
like
why.
You would say like, it felt like someone knocked you in the back of the head when you shot it back. I don't know. Victory gin. Sound like a freshman year drink.
I love the part where he's in O'Brien's office and he talks about drinking wine for the first time.
Like, it's going to be sweet. It's going to be super sweet.
Like, everything I've ever read says it's going to be this beautiful thing. And he drinks it and he's like, oh, nah. I don't like this.
Not into it.
What is 2 + 2?
4.
Fish.
Murder.
4, but yes, 4.
Both of them would be murdered. Because that's the thing in the book. Anyway, that's everything. Thank you for listening.
No.
Oh, wait.
I have just if I could interject myself.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
You hand me my copy of my book.
Tripp's got some stuff to say.
I just wanted to highlight a couple lines that I liked particularly throughout the book.
Classy. I love it.
Yes. On the way, we have the Singnet Classics version, so we might have the same book, but Signet, whatever it
it's
is.
Signet, I think.
Signet. Just a couple of lines that really struck me that I underlined. On page 19, describing the process of vaporization, of getting killed. Your one-time existence was denied and then forgotten. You were abolished, annihilated, vaporized was the usual word. That turn of phrase, your one-time existence was denied, is a great put-down. An absolutely...
this is some birds that Tripp has collected from the book.
Essentially.
Thank you, George Orwell.
On page 65, while describing sex, sexual intercourse was to be looked on as a slightly disgusting minor operation, like having an enema. Absolutely hilarious. There's a long paragraph that I won't read. Oh, okay. This one is this is Winston, you know, pontificating about the party and, you know, stuff in general. And it's not merely was the validity of experience, but the very existence of external reality was tacitly denied by their philosophy, talking about the party. The heresy of heresies was common sense. And what was terrifying was not that they would kill you for thinking otherwise, but that they might be right. For, after all, how do we know that 2 and 2 makes 4, or that the force of gravity works, or that the past is unchangeable? If both the past and the external world exist only in the mind, and if the mind itself is controllable, what then? Just a mind F for you right there. On page 179, Winston was gelatinous with fatigue. Gelatinous was the right word. I like when authors use a strange word like that, and they're like, yep, nope.
I did it on purpose.
Yep.
This is a note to my editor.
we talked about this earlier, and I don't know if you guys felt this, but on 221, like right when they get caught, and you know, we are the dead, he said, we are the dead, echoed Julia dutifully. You are the dead, said an iron voice behind them. Few times have books like given me like actual goosebumps or like actually, you know, made my heart palpitate. That "you are the dead" said an iron voice behind them line. That's really good stuff. Because
there's nothing before it. You're hearing
out of
them
nowhere,
talk, and all of a sudden,
you are the dead.
Another person talking, and it's their capture.
Dun dun dun! I thought that was really funny. That was like, you know, I'm sure scary for them, but I found it kind of funny. The iron voice is
just
like,
there.
Hey.
It's just there creeping, like, watching them bang.
I was so annoyed. So annoyed that they didn't get stopped earlier, and that like O'Brien brought them into his room and like set up this whole elaborate ordeal.
Why? So that he wrote. He wrote a fake book.
Are you sure? Are you sure it wasn't?
He
a
said
real
he
book?
Wrote it. Yeah.
Oh, did he say that?
Yeah. He said I wrote it. Yeah. He's like, you wrote the book. He's like, yeah, I wrote the book. It's
that
fake.
Way, when he's talking about the book, there's this part, this line he says. Let me find it really quick because I read it and I was like, that's not a real thing. There's a part where, hang on. George Orwell writes, writing for Winston. He just reads chapter one of the book, and he stops after the first paragraph.
I hated that part.
It says, Winston, it says, suddenly, as one sometimes does with a book of which one knows that one will ultimately read and reread every word, he opened it at a different place and found himself at the third chapter. I was like, hang on. I've read lots of books in my life. I've read lots of books that from the first page, I was like, yeah, I'm going to read and reread every word. I have never once in my life flipped open 3/4 of the way through and just started reading there. You don't do that.
I've done that. What? But I haven't read more than, like, I sometimes just like to like read a little bit and be like, ooh, that's an interesting sentence. I'm going to see how it leads up to that. Like, I never read a chapter in that convenient way to show the readers of 1984 what's in this secret book.
Secret.
And then I just had two more really quick funny sentences that aren't important, but I found actually hilarious. While Winston was describing the cell he was in before he was in the Ministry of Love, he describing a woman next to him, an enormous wreck of a woman aged about 60 with great tumbling breasts. Great tumbling breast, absolutely hilarious. A fantastic phrase. And then when he is in the Ministry of Love next with this Parsons fellow who sucked a lot, Parsons used the laboratory loudly and abundantly.
Laboratory.
Loudly and abundantly. Just really and good. Then, just really and then, good.
That was funny too because the guy walked into the room. He's like, hey, Winston, what's up? I know we're talking right now, but I gotta poop. And then he's like, oh, the drain doesn't work. And then he got taken away. So he's like, oh, cool. Well, I'm in this room.
I was in a restaurant when I read that part, and I like made a face.
The cell stank abominably for hours afterwards. A good capper.
Anyway, thank you for that, Trip. I really appreciate that. And thank you, Nick and Trip, for coming. This is really great. Thank you for listening. Thank you to Ms. Goodman, my English teacher, and to Trip's English teacher who told him to annotate books.
Oh, Dr. O'Brien, shout out to you. You're the best.
O'Brien.
Dun, dun, dun.
Like the character in the book. Okay.
We love Big Brother.
We love Big Brother. Down thank you for listening, and everybody keep reading because it's good for you. Goodbye.